Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Cold War Conversations.
If you're new here, you've come to the right place for first-hand Cold War history accounts. And thanks to financial supporter Jack Veselak for providing today's intro. Make sure you hit that follow button in your podcast app so you don't miss out on future episodes. The Jodrell Bank Observatory in Cheshire in the UK played a significant secret role during the Cold War. It was established in 1945 by Bernard Lovell, a radio astronomer at Manchester University, to investigate cosmic rays after his work on radar in the Second World War. We hear some intriguing details of the site's Cold War roles, including being Britain's first nuclear attack early warning station, and its signals intelligence collaboration with GCHQ, the UK's government communications headquarters. Even more surprisingly, it's also revealed how Soviet scientists also worked at the site, and that the Soviets attempted to get Bernard Lovell to defect during a visit to the Soviet Union. I'm given a tour of the non-public areas by Tim O'Brien, who's a professor of astrophysics. Do make sure you check out the extensive photos I took at coldwarconversations.com/episode327. I'm delighted to welcome Professor Tim O'Brien to our Cold War conversation.
We'll go down to the very south end of the site here just to see where Bernard Lovell first arrived here in 1945. So,
well, these buildings here look very 50s.
Prefab. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch. Well, you'll see when we walk through the rest of the site, there's a whole bunch of buildings that were the sort of first permanent buildings here when they realised they weren't leaving. And they were when Bernard Lovell was given permission by the botany department to bring his army trailers down here in 1945, and he had permission for 2 weeks to stay for 2 weeks, and he never left. So in about 1948 they thought, oh, well, perhaps we're actually here for a while. So they threw up all these, I guess they look like the sort of buildings you get on airfields and things.
Yeah, military, know, they military look like airfield. A military base.
That's
or something.
Almost certainly what the design is, to be honest. So,
cheap and cheerful.
Yeah, just sort of concrete frame thing. And some of them are grade two listed now as well.
Wow.
So. Obviously, the whole site's a World Heritage Site. But even before it was a World Heritage Site, we've got a number of listed buildings.
I've driven past it so many times.
Right.
It's so spectacular just seeing the Lovell telescope.
Yeah. I know, it's a bit remarkable, isn't it? And you can go, I mean, I live up in the hills over to the east of here, up in the peaks, and you can see it's the most obvious thing in the whole of the Cheshire Plain. You know, you can stand up on the peaks and look out west, and you've got the flat Cheshire Plain, and then you see the Welsh mountains on the horizon. You can see the cathedrals in Liverpool, and in between there's this white, amazing white structure. Sorry, you might wonder where we're going now, but we're squeezing round fences and down a little track. But basically, this area here we're in now was the bit that was owned by the University of Manchester before the war, and was set up as a botany experimental grounds, basically. So the botany department used to come out here and experiment growing different crops under different conditions and all this sort of thing. Okay. And the two huts that we're approaching now behind this big, I think it's a weeping beech actually, behind this
it's definitely weeping
tree. These are the sort of original potting sheds, so we call them the botany huts, but they're very sort of fundamental to the history of Jodrell Bank. I'll show you a picture of them from the day, because this is basically where Bernard Lovell arrived at. in December 1945.
When he arrived,
these were here. Yeah, they were built in the 1930s. They were the only buildings on the site. Yeah. These same two huts here.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, during World War II, he developed radar. He was involved in developing radar. Mm-hmm. So specifically, he developed. He led the team that developed the sort of airborne radar systems with the sort of classic sweeping round sort of cathode ray tube that you see. Initially for detecting surfaced U-boats, which would come up at night to replenish their air supply. And obviously they couldn't see them at night, so they had radar to try and get an echo off them on the surface. So they did that, and then they used them in sort of nighttime bombing raids as well over continental Europe. But he, at the end of the war, he just came back to the physics department in Manchester. Sort of chucked back into the university system, said, get on with your life. having sort of, you know, done this major work in the war. And he thought, oh, what am I going to do? Oh, I'll carry on what I was doing before, studying cosmic rays, particles that arrive from outer space, come into the atmosphere. And then he thought, maybe I can use this radar technology that's new. Maybe that can help us in our study of cosmic rays. So he had this kit, borrowed these sort of anti-aircraft radar systems from his mates in the army, and took it into Manchester, set it up, and his idea was that he could send a radio signal up into the atmosphere, and it would reflect back off the trail of ions, ionized material in the atmosphere that this cosmic ray would leave behind it. He set up in Manchester. And it was being ruined by interference, radio interference from trams or trolley buses, maybe, I don't know, that had like sparking, you know, sparks coming. And that was that basically produced these bursts of radio waves that were just destroying his results. So he was like, well, where can I go away from the city? And then he heard about the botany grounds here, and they said, why don't you take the stuff out there? Yeah. So he arrived sort of in, show you the picture, he arrived in December of 1945. So these are the army trucks sort of taking them into this muddy field here.
Yeah, yeah.
And these are the two huts, which you can see at this angle to each other here. That's the hut there on the left.
Yeah.
In fact, if you want to squeeze around here, you can come around and have a look. we can almost stand in the same position from up there, which is fun. But based somewhere over here, roughly, I don't know. Somewhere around.
Sort of like a then and now.
They've added some windows. Well, no, they haven't. I think you just can't see them in this. That's the sort of view he had. So his radar kit was just to the right of the huts there. I had this suspicion that the sapling in here might even be this tree. I'm not sure I can prove that for certain.
Gosh.
But basically, this is them setting the radar.
Yeah, so this is an army surplus kit.
It's army surplus kit, yeah. And you can see that, you know, it's got the camouflage gear on the truck here, and these two people here are local farmers, and these guys are all from the army.
Yeah.
So they came to help, and they were sort of pushing it through the mud. As you can see, it's still probably a bit muddy now. So he basically that's, you know, the origins of Jodrell Banker in the Second World War. So Lovell did have this, you know, military connection, if you like, from the outset, really. And they did use lots of surplus equipment. So they used to drive around the country in a truck and chuck stuff in the back, you know, that would have otherwise been tipped down mine shafts or something, I believe, they were getting rid of at the end of the war. So they used to collect loads of stuff, you know, loads of gear, electronics and, you know, equipment, and oscilloscopes and whatever they could find, just to pile up here. But they worked out of these huts for... certainly into the late 1940s, maybe the early 1950s, they were still using some of these huts as like a canteen, and the sort of more permanent concrete huts on the northern part of the site were then built to replace them. So we just walked past a hut that was became the replacement canteen for one of these huts. But these are still here, and we've renovated them recently. To make sure that they, you know, they're retained as part of our heritage.
So they listed these?
They're listed as part of effectively the World Heritage Site.
Because the whole site is listed.
Effectively the whole site's grade one listed now.
Because they look like something you'd see in a prisoner of war camp or something like that, aren't they?
They are, yeah. They were effectively the potting sheds. So when he arrived he arrived late November 1945.
Yeah.
And he brought the kit here in early December 1945. And so they haven't been used. They continue to be used by the botany department into the 1990s, I think. Well, they haven't been used since the 1990s, so they were at risk a little bit. So we had a project to just sort of recover them, make sure the roofs are fixed, and they're actually,
they're not in bad nick.
This is original stuff. Yeah. These windows and everything.
I mean, considering it's been out in the
balmy weather of Cheshire. Yeah, but they're nice. They're nice buildings, and we'll. Over the years, we bring people down here to have a look at them on tours and things like that. We may use them for something in the future, but at the moment they're here as a monument almost.
It's quite nice the way that there's almost that air of dereliction around them. You don't want to ruin that. It makes it more special.
There's sort of something interesting in the summer when you walk down this track that we just walked down. This big weeping beech, when it's in leaf, it hides them completely.
Yeah.
So you bring people down, you go, they've no idea where they're going. And then you sometimes squeeze through these branches here. I sometimes wander through, and then suddenly they're visible. Yeah. And then, like you say, you can show people the old photos and say, well, look, there's what it was. So they basically used to come off the road here.
Right.
The entrance was just over there.
Okay.
Into that site, and this area was all it was.
So this was all the land they had.
This was all the land they had at that point. Was these fields here?
Right.
And then basically Lovell, he detected echoes, so they switched on the equipment, and he immediately started getting these echoes. And he was like, "Oh, that's a surprising rate of echoes. That's not really quite. Didn't expect quite that many." And then asking around, there was another guy who was in the army called Hay, J.S. Hay, who was also did a lot of really good working in detecting radio waves from outer space in those days. And he said, I think what they are actually is they're echoes from meteors. Wow. So where shooting stars come through the atmosphere, they leave an ionized trail. So you get echoes from those as well. So Lovell at that time knew nothing about astronomy. And he had to quickly learn astronomy, basically, because he realized he'd got this kit and he could study these meteors, and they did. So that was a huge amount of the first part of the work here at Jodrell, was using radar to study meteors.
So that was the discovery of radio astronomy.
Well, the subject didn't exist. So there was if you sort of search through the history books, you won't find the term radio astronomy being used till about 1948.
Right.
So before the Second World War, there was a couple of Americans, Carl Jansky and then Grote Reber, who were sort of pioneers of detecting radio waves from outer space. But both of them were effectively radio engineers, but did some important work. But then effectively the war got in the way, and their own jobs got in the way, actually. Yeah. They're working for companies that really didn't want them working, too distracted. Certainly in the case of Carl Jansky, getting too distracted by what he was working for Bell Telephone Labs, by what he was discovering coming from outer space. So it sort of didn't go anywhere, and it almost got reinvented again from scratch with these people in the Second World War, with the radar work in the Second World War. There was a group here at Jodrell under Lovell. There was a group at Cambridge under Martin Ryle. And there was a group out in Sydney in Australia under people like Boeing and others, Pawsey and people like this. But they all sort of came out of the radar work on the sort of allied side.
Yeah. So they all came out of that military technology
and
the expertise that they'd picked up out of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so that's sort of all grew up then from 1945 onwards. But then basically when Lovell he realised that this was interesting and it was something he wasn't expecting, but he also realised that when he was working out this idea about getting echoes off cosmic rays, he decided he sort of realised that the he'd done a mistake in his calculations, and the signal, the echo he would have got from a cosmic ray trail was far weaker than he'd predicted by a factor of several thousand. And so he would never have detected it. We'll walk around here, actually. I think we'll be okay. This radar kit, it was too small to detect the weak signal, so he decided he had to build a really big aerial. So he came north, where we are now, a bit north of the Botany Grounds, which finished there, and he came into this field.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
And basically in this field, in this area here, he ended up building what was at the time, he didn't realise it, but was at the time the world's biggest radio telescope. It was a fixed ball, sort of steel wires, cables, and scaffolding poles. And so he basically made a big circle that filled this whole area all the way around here to the edge of roughly where that building is and over to the scaffolding poles, and then wires hanging in it, and then wires going round and round. And there was him, another guy called John Clegg. He got the family involved. The kids used to come at the weekend and twist wires together and stuff. And they built this thing that was 218 feet in diameter, a big sort of ball pointing straight upwards effectively. The sort of edges of it were as high as they could reach with the ladders that they happened to have.
So it wasn't, and how was he financing this?
That was done with just very incredibly limited funds. So just from the university, that particular project. So there was no external funding involved at all initially. The only bit that they, and it was the first grant, sort of government grant, effectively research grant that he got, was for the pole that was in the middle. So you imagine this big ball sitting there. Radio waves come from above and they reflect off this ball and they're gathered together at a focus.
Yeah.
And that focus has to be on the top of a big long pole in the middle.
Yeah.
So he actually got the money to get materials to build a strong enough pole.
Right.
So that was his first grant. And then the radio aerial at the top that was the receiver. But yeah, the biggest telescope in the world at the time, it's called the Transit Telescope. Because he wanted to detect cosmic rays, he still didn't detect cosmic rays. In fact, John, we never detected cosmic rays. It was the main thing he was interested in, but we never did it. But what they did see with that was the sort of the radio waves just coming from the universe. So they weren't echoes, they weren't radar echoes coming back. They were just being generated out in space and they were arriving. So you could see the stuff between the stars in the Milky Way is a big bright sort of stripe across the sky, and they started picking up these very strong sort of point sources that they call radio stars originally, which were, you know, light stars in the radio sky, that they had no idea what they were, and they had no counterpart in the visible sky, so they were very strange things. And we now know that a lot of those are the quasars, the sort of distant galaxies powered by supermassive black holes. But that was a whole pioneering discovery thing.
Yeah.
And as soon as he'd done that, are you happy to walk around?
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
As soon as he'd done that, he thought, oh, actually, and he was persuaded by others. There was another guy called Robert Hanbury Brown, who was also an ex-radar person who joined him by then. Persuaded by this discovery and by these other people that this was the big thing. This is what we now know as radio astronomy. And so the limitation of this device that was here, and there are a few, there's little remnants, I won't go and show you, but if you wander around, there's little bits of concrete dotted around, you know, you can find it in the ground that are the remnants of it. And there's also, we did a resistivity survey, and you can see the cable runs under the ground here from this.
So it's sort of like by accident, instrument. Then.
Totally by accident. There's loads of accidents in this two-tracker bang. For example, if he'd realised that he'd made a mistake of several thousand in his calculation, he would never have come here to try and do the work with the radar equipment. So Jorobank would never have existed if it weren't for him making that error.
Yeah.
His excuse was that they were being machine gunned by German fighters at the time, which I suppose is a reasonable excuse.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
It's more than,
as excuses go, that's a pretty
It's better than
one.
Most people's excuses for a calculator error. But anyway, he sort of thought, okay, this is great, you know, this is interesting stuff. Nobody knows what it is, where these radio waves are coming from. The limitation of that big instrument was that it didn't steer.
Yeah.
So it only looks
so it's just on a fixed mount.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The ball just sat there. All you could do is you could tip the pole a little bit, which effectively points in slightly different directions, but you couldn't go right over because you quickly lose a signal. So if you can imagine here where we are now, I'm sort of looking west now.
Mm.
And east over here. So obviously, as the Earth rotates, everything in the sky moves round east to west above us. So it effectively could see a sort of stripe of sky that goes overhead.
Yeah.
But everything over there and everything over there, most of the sky they couldn't observe. So he needed something he could tip.
And even with the seasons and the different times of year, you wouldn't see different sky. It's still the same.
It's the same. Yeah. Same strip. Yeah. Right. So you're, basically, if you think about the Earth, you know, sitting there with its axis spinning like that, it just spins like that.
Yeah.
And, okay, it goes around the sun, but that thing stays the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's just this one strip around the sphere that you see.
You can tell I'm not a scientist.
No, it's okay. It's all right. So that was why he wanted to build what became the Lovell telescope, which is there now, because that the power of that is, one, is it's big, so it's 250 feet. In old money, 76 metres in diameter, the ball. So big, even bigger than the one they originally built here. But the power being that it can tip right down to the horizon.
And
it can turn
traverse,
all the way around.
Yeah.
So it can see the whole of the visible sky. So a very powerful instrument. In fact, so powerful that it's still, you know, the third biggest steerable telescope in the world today.
Wow.
So, you know, when it was built in the 50s, it was the biggest. So it was quite a remarkable achievement. And at that point, you know, your question, you know, funding-wise, then, yeah, you do need some significant funding there.
Yeah.
And he did have to get government grants, and it was a major problem, because their original cost estimate was about £120,000 in money of the day. And that would have been in, you know, around about 1950 or so, 1951, they put that together. It ended up costing about £750,000. So it was a factor 6 or 7 times more expensive than what they originally predicted, which, you know, we're used to that these days.
Well, yeah.
Big projects.
Yeah, you think HS2, that's probably...
Yeah. So it's...
But again, I mean, this was almost made out of recycled materials and stuff like that, because I read somewhere they used some of the turret traverse mechanisms from former...
Yep.
World War One, World War Two battleships.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you can see them from here, actually. It's on the towers at the sides. So look at that right-hand tower going up.
Yeah. The thing on the end next to the tower.
Yeah, so the left-hand edge of that tower at the top edge, you're seeing edge on a disc.
Yeah.
Can you see that sort of thin white?
Yeah.
That's an edge on. Inside that are those gear racks. So the motor's in the top of the tower.
Right.
And it has a pinion that goes into the rack that turns and that tips the telescope. So inside though, there are indeed the 15-inch gun turret gear racks from two World War One battleships.
Wow.
HMS Revenge and HMS Royal Sovereign, which were scrapped at the end of the Second World War.
Yeah.
One of them was in the Battle of Jutland, but I can't remember which one now. But yeah, we've still got them in there. We've got about 100 years of spurs, according to our engineers. Occasionally you get a crack and we've got a whole pile of replacements, so they can cut a bit out, take a bit out, replace it with another bit.
What, bits still from Royal Sovereign and Revenge?
Yeah, stacked up in one of our store huts, yeah. So it's...
Wow.
It's amazing, isn't it? It was good quality steel, apparently.
Well, it was pre-nuclear weapons as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it wasn't the...
Yeah, no, so it was, yeah, it was better stuff. But yeah, the engineer, Charles Husband, who designed it and built it, took, he heard about these things being broken up and just went up to this Scottish shipyard and collected the bits and brought them back down. So, yeah, there was a lot of... There's a whole history of make, do and mend, which, you know, we still continue today. We do as much as we can for as little expense as we can. So, but yeah, so that we should perhaps carry on walking. Yeah. I mean, we're walking around the perimeter of what we grandly call the green, which is this green space in the middle of the site, and still used today for the purposes it was always used for, which is to do random experiments. So there's a whole bunch of antennas in front of you that were a student experiment. There's another sort of thing over there behind that. You probably can't tell what's going on, but there's a structure that's called a screen. It's got mesh on it.
Yeah, I can see it.
And it's screening an instrument that's in behind the tarpaulin behind it, right, which is a new telescope that's been just built and tested at the moment that will eventually go to South America somewhere. And having said that, the little pile of slightly rusty-looking material in the middle there is the base of the earliest radio telescope equipment we have on site, which is... it's the bottom part of a World War II searchlight. And what they did, again, they persuaded the army to lend it to them. Never gave it back, as you can see.
Yeah.
But they borrowed it. And they effectively, all they wanted it for was because it was on a mount that would turn and tip. And so they strapped a load of scaffolding poles to it, wired it up, basically made it a mount for a huge sort of radar aerial. And they used to use that to study the meteor showers. 1946, that arrived on site. And those are the remains. We've just been looking after them recently. So they were inside a big
Can I just have a quick look at that, take a photo?
Yeah. No, so they'd not been used. The mount carried on being used till probably late 1970s. Maybe early 80s, just for the same purpose. Wanted to just... they just sit something on it. We might have to negotiate.
Yeah.
Muddy sections of ground, I'm afraid.
No, don't worry.
It's sort of nice to have.
Well, it's definitely seen better days, isn't it?
It has seen better days, yeah. It is actually a real instrument, and it is the earliest... It's the only remains we have of the earliest instrument on the site. So this is... you can see it was on a trailer.
Yeah.
Originally. And that's the turntable in the middle that the thing rotated on.
It's incredible.
So it's been mounted into the ground, into concrete blocks to hold it. But basically, it was quite a big instrument with these big sort of scaffolding arms sticking out the side, and they basically pushed it around and pointed it in different directions so they could check the echoes from meteors coming in from different directions. There's all these concrete troughs that used to have cable runs running in them and so on. So this whole field, this whole area was sort of, in the history of the site, it's always been used for this sort of thing. To be honest, it's one of the attributes of this place as a World Heritage Site now. You sort of decide what the attributes of your site are, and some of the attributes are the big telescopes. But other attributes are the way these buildings, you'd see them now, that these cream buildings with the blue doors dotted around the edges of this green. This is where the astronomers moved to this field in 1946 when they sort of outgrew the botany ground. They moved north and came into this field and then into this field.
Yeah.
And this was the heart of the site until the Lovell telescope was completed.
So was this land owned by the university then?
No, they bought it.
So they had to buy it from the farm.
Yeah.
Farmer.
Yeah. There is a story, and I can't check now because the burner's no longer with us, that he basically just, you know, would go in the field, have a chat with the farmer and start pouring concrete and then negotiate the university buying it off them. So that sounds like him,
brilliant,
to be honest. But,
brilliant. Yeah.
He was an interesting character. He wouldn't let things stand in his way.
Yeah.
And my feeling is he got that. Maybe he was always like that, but certainly I think during the Second World War, you can imagine being in charge of something that was a major project involving the defence of the whole country. He got used to getting the things he wanted.
Yeah, it's of national importance.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and as he just said, I think this is important, I'm going to have it. I don't really mind what you say, I'm going to do it anyway.
Wow.
But we'll cut just over here, actually, if we can avoid the puddles. Yeah, he told this funny story where he said when he, you know, it was 1 week towards the end of the war, where he said I could ring up and order 2 Lancaster bombers. And then the next week, when he was in the physics department back in Manchester, he couldn't even get a screwdriver from the stores. So it was a bit of a shock to the system. Yeah. I think.
So the radar system he was working on during the war, was it the ground-facing sort of like navigation radar as well?
Yeah.
That was H2S. Right.
So he was the team leader for H2S.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, because that's really... I mean, because that then evolved further post-war.
Yeah.
And... sort of successor to that system that's in like the Vulcan bomber in the 1960s and 70s.
No, so they did a number of different development. I mean, you probably know more about it than me. He's written a good book called The Echoes of War.
Yeah.
I mean, he writes very detailed books, Lovell, so they're all based on his diaries. But it tells the story of everything that happened and all the different developments going to different frequencies of operation. Mounting it in different ways and all this sort of stuff, you know, that they were just, you know, obviously making it up as they went along, because they as quickly as they could, basically.
Well, it was brand new technology at the time, wasn't
it?
Really?
Of course, so. No, everything was new. So these huts had different research groups in them, and they were all named according to the group that worked in them. So the hut here is called Moon Hut, still called Moon Hut, because the people that worked in there used to use radar to study the moon.
Right.
So they would bounce radio waves off the moon and then look at the quality of the signal received, and it would tell them something about the moon's properties and surface. And obviously this began before the moon landings.
Yeah.
Whereas the hut we're standing next to here is the Radiant Hut, because it was where the meteor research group worked. And if you know anything about meteor showers, you may have heard of things like the Perseids or the Geminids.
Yeah.
So they went, when the meteors, when we run through this cloud, the Earth moves through this cloud of dust left behind by a comet or an asteroid or something, then the sort of relative velocity of the Earth and the meteors means they all, just in a perspective effect, like railway lines all meeting at a point as you look along them into the distance, all the meteor trails all appear to go back to a point.
Right.
And that point on the sky is in a particular constellation, and that's what gives them the name. But that, so the Geminids come from a point in Gemini, Perseids in a point in Perseus, and so on. But this, that point is called the Radiant that they all radiate from. So this is Radiant.
This is the
so it was, it's sort of, that one was Cosmic Noise Hut. Because the people that worked in there, I said early on they were all using radar. Then they realised there was these radio waves arriving anyway that were not, we'd not generated and bounced off something. And so that was called cosmic noise. It was cosmic noise in the radio that was coming from space. So that's quite an evocatively named hut.
Sounds a great name for a band.
Must have a band called that. Yeah, it'd be a great thing to do. Lovell's office and the sort of main offices were in that one over there, in that hut over there. And there was a workshop in that one, and there still is a workshop there. But then when they built the big Lovell telescope, they moved the main offices over there, and we'll go and have a look in there in a minute. I mean, just while I'm here, for the benefit of your recording.
No, go on.
Just because we're standing next to an interesting place. While the Lovell telescope was being built, there were sort of secret conversations between Lovell and some people in the military, that he had those connections anyway, about whether they might be able to use it with a radar on it in order to detect aircraft or whatever, right? And of course he was involved in radar during the war. You might have expected him to think about that, and they did provide some funding actually to let it work at a shorter wavelength than it was originally designed to. So they put a solid surface on, that means it can work at a shorter wavelength, which was going to be useful to them for the radar work, as well as for some science as well, for the hydrogen line in outer space. But that connection eventually led in, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, it led to this telescope being on standby as the early warning radar system for missile attack during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So they had they basically trained some RAF personnel to drive the telescope and to operate radar kit, and, you know, point the telescope east.
Yeah.
And they knew where the launch sites were from intelligence agents. So they knew where to roughly point the telescope, and then obviously it would give them however many minutes warning that there was something coming. And you know, if you hear this story, that story became public a few years ago now, when the materials became public in the National Archives. Bernard Lovell and Graham Smith, who was the director after St Bernard, Sir Francis Graham Smith, to give him his full title, they wrote a little paper about it called Diversions of a Radio Telescope. Lovell, when he would tell that story, would always say it was designed to give this, you know, whatever it was, 7-minute warning or something,
yeah,
that would potentially have saved millions of lives in London. And of course, Simon, who's my colleague, is one of the other associate directors here in charge of the observatory, would say, well, you know, you can look through the papers and you can read about what would have happened if they detected an echo. And they wouldn't have been serving a million lives in London. No. What they would have been doing is launching the Vulcan bombers.
Exactly, to incinerate the Soviet Union.
To incinerate and therefore, you know, do the mutually assured destruction thing. So it wasn't about getting...
No.
I think Lovell was probably saying these things for almost, you know, for public consumption, if you like. But it wasn't about getting people into, maybe a few people into bunkers, but certainly not millions of people. So it was for that reason. I mean, so we got like all the records of... We've got all the log books that have the telescope log that show you the days in the months leading up to the, you know, the weekend of the ultimate weekend of the
Black
Cuban
Saturday
Missile Crisis. So we've got all the records that show that, sure enough, there were RAF people, says in the logbook RAF, for example, that they were here testing out the radar, and they tested it on things, maybe a Canberra or something,
right? Okay.
Flying overhead. Yeah. It was one of the first tests they did just to show they could detect something.
But they would detect, you know, they'd be trying to detect at really long range.
Yeah, yeah. The range was about okay. They did detect, but it was on the hairy edge of detectability, and it's not. And there are discussions, there are documents in the archives that say they weren't really sure, you know, how much convinced they could be by it. Would they be convinced enough to launch Vulcan bombers?
Exactly. I mean, wasn't there a danger of a false positive?
Absolutely.
And
now, we've been through the records, we've looked at that weekend. There's no evidence that on that weekend they came and they got set up and they took control and they were ready. And again, you know, Simon's research and others, I'm sure, you may know a lot more about than me. But... The idea at that point, the main aim was to reduce tension, not to increase it. And so the idea that they would have actually done anything, it's probably the case that they wouldn't have actually done anything.
It's probably, potentially looking at having something so they're not completely reliant on the Americans to let them know.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's some other way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, Fylingdales was... the workers were on strike, weren't they, at Fylingdales?
Right. I didn't think it was operational then.
No, so it wasn't. No, so they hadn't finished building it, basically. So that was why. I'm just going to show you.
So Jodrell Bank was effectively Britain's first early warning system for nuclear attack.
Yes.
Again, by chance.
I mean, this is Lovell.
Late 1950s, he said, is there any chance that we could make use of your telescope? I said, why? He said, well, Fylingdales, the ballistic missile early warning station, is hindered by strikes. And if we have your permission, we'd like to use your telescope instead until it's available.
This is a picture from... This is sort of the rough range that we would have, you know. So it reached the sort of...
The Urals, maybe?
Yeah. Well,
it's sort of...
They had sites here, apparently, in, you know, around Latvia and Lithuania, places like, you know, in that sort of part of the USSR, I think. This is Radiant Hut that we're standing in front of now.
Wow.
So that's Radiant Hut. Look, it's exactly the same. And there's the Lovell telescope over there. These are some of the Urals I was talking about. But basically, literally through this window here were these two radar consoles. So this is the type that was used. This is not a photo of the ones in here, but there's these console type 61s.
So this is where the RAF.
This is where the RAF
would have been using Radiant Hut, sitting in this room, looking out for.
And two operators, I think, for redundancy, checking up on each other and so on. But those were installed in this room, and the really funny thing, the really funny story. This is again from the National Archives. This is a map of the sites. It says entrance to Jodrell Bank, which is where we came in down here. It says RAF Jodrell Bank, and you can see it's in this corner of this thing here, and then it goes round, and there's the control building over there and the telescope.
Yeah.
But then this is a sketch of this building. It says here RAF room, say, console, console. And then, interestingly, it says workshop in which Russian students work here. And it says, this wall soundproofed, this wall not soundproofed yet.
Brilliant.
And basically, these two guys, they're not actually Russian, they're Armenian, Soviet.
Yeah, yeah.
They were there. They were here at the time because Lovell and others collaborated with Soviet scientists on astronomy. And these two guys were visiting to work with Lovell on radio emission from stars, Paris Haruni and Grant Tovmassian. And they were in there.
Brilliant.
From the Soviet Union during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Right through that period, right next door to where...
Brilliant.
And there's a hilarious thing about this wall soundproof, this wall not soundproof.
Yeah.
Which sort of makes you think, you know, it's almost...
Unbelievable.
Couldn't quite make it up, could you?
So the consoles were facing that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And underneath each of these windows around here.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So I think they were... I think it says here on this thing, windows covered with black opaque material.
Right, okay.
So these two,
Armenians couldn't see when they were going off to their lunch break what was going on in there.
So they were sat inside there in front of looking at the consoles that way, yeah.
Excellent.
Isn't that amazing?
That is great.
And it definitely was the case. I spoke to there's a colleague who's not with us anymore, but he was the sort of secret. He was charged. He was the technical person who was allowed to know about secret stuff. So he confirmed. I checked with him that it was indeed this hut, because the map only shows one hut, and we weren't sure if it was that one or that one.
Yeah.
But he's confirmed it was definitely this one. He used to go in with them and help them set stuff up and whatever. But basically, they certainly tested it. They trained them right for months beforehand. I can't remember when it started, a year before, or I don't know when it started, sometime quite a while before. But no evidence that they ever did anything right around the peak crisis time. And like you say, all those questions about would they have believed it if they got an echo? Was it just above the noise? I think they were worrying about whether things were just above the noise level. And would you seriously launch a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union on the basis
based
of a bit of extra... stuff above the noise in this one thing. Luckily it never got to that. So
let me take a photo of Radiant Hut.
If you want to take a photo of the hut with the telescope behind, that's probably a good idea, isn't it?
That's what I wanna...
Sorry, I jumped ahead in the story slightly, but it's an opportunity to walk around.
Absolutely to you know, give the history.
I mean, the other thing that's going to be in your shot now these days, of course, is the, if you decide to put it in, is the SKAO Global Headquarters there. But,
and what does that acronym stand for?
Square Kilometre Array Observatory, which is a big new radio telescope that's been built in South Africa and Australia. But the international headquarters is here, so this is a new building here. So it's historically, this was just a field.
Right.
In my memory. If you wanted to go in the building, we could, but there's not.
No, it's all right.
It's just a storeroom at
the
moment.
It's just...
You can see people storing various things in there. Get my reflection in there if you're not careful.
That's okay.
But that's a little bit of
Brilliant.
Cold War history.
Oh, no, I love that. That's the sort of stuff I love.
Is that,
you know, top secret.
Yeah,
we've got two Russians next door.
Well, look, Simon found that document in the archive. He went down to Kew to look in the archives, and they were sort of inventing this as they went along. And it's like that whole thing about the Soviets coming here is a whole interesting story of Jodrell Bank and the Cold War, because, of course, you know, obviously we're on the western side, if you like. But on the other hand, we did sort of sit between the USA and the Soviet Union in this almost neutral position where both sides used to use the telescope, because it was the biggest telescope in the world when it was built, to track their spacecraft.
Yeah, it's one of those few areas of the Cold War where there was a degree of collaboration in the scientific sphere. Because was it true that the Soviets really wanted to prove that they weren't lying?
Because the Americans, if they wanted to, and some of them did, would just denied that they were capable of doing these things that they claimed they were doing. Just to go back to the story, we'll go in the building in a minute. But we're in front of the control building now, so the brick bit of the building was built at the same time as the big Lovell telescope behind it, it was known as the 250-foot telescope when it was first built, now the Lovell telescope. So it was designed all about housing the control room for that telescope. Just coincidentally, the very first thing it did, pretty much, was to be fitted with a radar, borrowing one of the radar kits off the Meteor group, just in the hut back there, fit it on the telescope, and they used it to get a radar echo from the rocket that carried Sputnik 1 into space in October 57. And that was motivated again by a government connection who got hold of Lovell and said, could you try and get an echo off the carrier rocket? The reason being it was the same rocket that carried the
ICBM.
The ICBMs. Yeah. So it was like, well, and then that links, you know, to this story.
So then they'd have a radar signature of what one of these looked like.
And they would know that they could also, in principle, they could provide an early warning detection of such a missile at some point. So that was why they did that particular... It wasn't anything to do with Sputnik itself, because you could pick up the Sputnik signal with a little radio receiver. And in fact, you could see, I believe, the carrier rocket. You could see with the naked eye, just like you can see the International Space Station reflecting sunlight. You could see the carrier rocket as a bright point of light going over.
Yeah.
Well, just it orbited the Earth for a while before it burnt up. So you could see it going over, but demonstrating that you could use a radar to detect a missile effectively. And then the next bit of the story follows on from that, really, which was a bit of the story that we only... we only became aware of very recently, or at least had confirmed, which was that for years, for as long as I've known, and there was always a rumour that the men from Cheltenham were involved.
Right, so GCHQ.
And in fact, the story was that these people would arrive and they would go upstairs here into the control building. You know, was it? And it was a rumour. Hmm. Nobody had it confirmed.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information.
When we were designing our new exhibition in the new building in the visitor facility up to the north here, I decided I ought to try and find out whether this was true or not. So I thought, well, okay, I need to get a hold of GCHQ. How do you get a hold of GCHQ? I'll go on the website, and I couldn't see a contact telephone number, but there was a web form. You could fill in a web form with questions. And I went, oh, okay. So I put myself down. Maybe I put media. Well, I don't know what the options were now. Maybe I said media as a press. And I just said, oh, hello, I work at Jodrell Bank. And were doing an exhibition. I've heard rumours that GCHQ used to work with Jodrell Bank. I don't know whether they're true or not. Could somebody get in touch? If, yeah. And then the historian at GCHQ indeed got in touch. And so we've worked with him on sort of uncovering some of the stories, and they were able to speak to a colleague here who is no longer with us, who was the technician in charge of the working with them, Bob Pritchard, from the early 60s onwards. And they had a chat to him actually before he died and said, look, it's okay, you can talk about this stuff now, because he would never...
He'd sign the act.
He'd signed the act.
Yeah.
He got his dog licences, how he referred to it. And he would be very... He would tell you so much, and then he would just sort of deny doing anything else. He sort of suspected there was more to it. But yeah, sure enough. So in fact, what we didn't know, and I'm not even sure whether Bob knew this, but David Abritat, who's the GCHQ historian now, confirmed this from their archives, from their records, that as soon as Sputnik was launched, they actually posted a member of GCHQ to here, to Jodrell Bank, which I suppose now you think back on it, you think, well, maybe that's obvious.
Yeah.
But they posted someone here and then continued that that connection right throughout.
Yeah.
Well, we don't really know when, I don't know when it ended.
Yeah.
Almost certainly well into the 1980s.
But it wasn't obvious this person was working for GCHQ. They had some other role.
I assume not. They must have had. I need to find out more. We're going to look in more into it.
One of the cleaners or something. Perhaps not that sort of subterfuge. But.
Certainly, only about three people here would have known.
Yeah.
Maybe even fewer than that. Yeah. Lovell would have known.
Yeah.
Possibly his deputy, which is a guy called J.G. Davis, I think, was also... knew about these things. And then Bob didn't arrive till the early 60s, so he wasn't here in 57, so he wasn't involved. So maybe it was only those two. So they must have given him some job, a technical job, because he went on the telescope and things. But he was basically, you know, what they were interested in was seeing what the Soviets were doing. Obviously, their job is to intercept communications, and that's what we did. And we did it for decades. Right through into the 1980s, judging by some of the photos we've seen. Right.
So we then move into the main control building for the telescope.
I'll go down there in a minute.
Okay.
We've got a colleague, we're just discussing the history of the Cold War on a podcast. So whether you'll feature on the recording we're doing at the moment, I don't know. How are you? Are you all right? We'll cut you out if you say anything controversial.
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, great. My listeners will be delighted.
And you're not doing anything secret?
No. We won't tell them about the alien or the red telephone.
No, exactly. I used to make up this story that we used to have a secret alien holding facility in the basement.
Brilliant.
And then I started worrying that some people in the talks were actually thinking, no, maybe it's just a double bluff. Maybe they do have a secret alien holding facility. Let me just see if I can find what I was going to show you. Yeah, so this... this sort of history of this link to GCHQ. Mm. This is the person that was stationed here. But this is a photo taken clearly much later, at least the 1980s, possibly the early 90s, judging by the clothes.
Yeah.
But of GCHQ people upstairs. Right. We'll go upstairs and have a look in a minute. So basically, this was the stated mission: intercept signals from Soviet reconnaissance satellites, orbital weapons and space probes.
Yes.
And apparently Jodrell Bank was given a GCHQ station number.
Right.
So it was treated as a GCHQ listening station.
But they were after...
They were after...
Signals intelligence. So it's SIGINT.
So they were intercepting signals, So they were...
So from radar... installations in the Soviet Union.
Mainly transmissions from the spacecraft.
Okay.
So they would have a listening station. There was one that I don't remember the name of now, almost directly south of the launch sites. So whether it was in Turkey or somewhere over there, basically on an allied sort of friendly side, if you like, they would know when the launch happened,
right?
And then they would communicate that back to here, so we would be ready to listen out, or
So you're listening signals. To the communications from their ground control to the
So both voice communications and if there was any people on board eventually, but initially it would have just been telemetry.
Right, diagnostic.
Data.
Yeah.
And obviously I think the aim was just to find out what they were doing, what they were up to, what their capabilities, the technological level was and so on. But you know, various bits of that story became known. I mean, this is a sort of press photo of the three people that I'm aware of that knew what was going on secretly. So Bernard Lovell, J.G. Davis, his deputy, and Bob Pritchard, sitting in front of equipment up in Lab 5, which you can go and have a look at in a minute, which was effectively the secret space tracking lab. But that's a press photo, 1967, and it's when the Soviets had a space probe that went into the atmosphere of Venus, and we tracked it. So some of these missions that became publicly known, it was aware that Jodrell Bank was tracking them.
Yeah.
Of course, it was never mentioned why. It was just because we were interested in Venus and whatever. But in fact, in reality, alongside these people, but not in the photograph, would have been people from GCHQ. And they recorded the signals and they were immediately dispatched to GCHQ and to US intelligence agency as well. Let's go and have a look at Lab 5, if you like.
Yeah.
So this is all the original building, sort of 1955.
It's a lovely 1950s vibe to it.
It has. We like it. It's got lovely banisters.
I like these wooden banisters.
Hello. I'm not disturbing you at all, I hope. I'm just showing someone round. This is Lab 5.
Right.
So this is where this photo was taken.
Yeah.
Possibly that we're not quite sure exactly where in this room it was, where this equipment was. But this behind here, blocked off now, because there's a false ceiling below, a window's down into the control room. So you can see, for example, if you have someone like this, this is Alla Maceevich and her colleague, Julie Kodarev, visiting in 1961, and they were trying to pick up signals from a spacecraft that the Soviets had sent to Venus and had lost. So they visited here and sat in this room and see these windows.
Yeah.
They looked down in, that's the control room below there.
Okay.
So that picture must have been taken just at the end of this room here. So this is where all this work would have happened. But here's, you know, there's another, we'll just nip downstairs. That's another example of where there were Soviets coming to work with the scientists here for scientific reasons, but at the same time, they would have come with a KGB.
Well, a shopping list of, this, and this.
And the thing is, with that, vice versa, you know, visits the other way happened as well.
Yeah.
So there's a famous visit of Lovell to the Soviet Union in 1963. He went a number of times, but famous one in 1963, sort of following these visits from Maceevich, where he was invited back and, you know, he was visiting various places, including the people who'd been working with, you know, on his research work. But then when he arrived, so basically said, okay, we're going to change the plans, we're going to take you to this place in Crimea, which is on the coast of the Black Sea in Crimea, which was basically their secret tracking facility. So they showed him around this place, which is the top secret facility. And Lovell was a bit, why are they showing me around this place? Lineups of people to meet him and all this. And then when he got back from that, they basically tried to persuade him to stay.
Right.
So it was like...
It was an offer for him to defect.
Exactly, yeah. So they said to him, you know, what are your plans? And he said, well, I'm currently designing a much bigger telescope than the one we have to be sited in North Wales and whatever. And they said, oh, how much will that cost, do you think? He says, oh, maybe 10 million or something. And they said, oh, don't worry, money's no object. That might even be an annual budget. Yeah, stay here and we'll build it.
Yeah.
And his famous phrase was, he said, "I'm an Englishman and I want to return to England."
Brilliant.
But they did. They let him out. But he was very, very well aware on that visit there were other people there who were not allowed out. Definitely not. Yeah. And there were people coming to him privately at parties while he was there,
yeah,
begging him to see if he could get a word in to let so-and-so get out of the Soviet Union. So he was very aware it was a serious situation. And in fact, when he came back, he was very ill. And he'd had a debriefing meeting with intelligence agents here after he got back. And they said to him, "Oh, well, it's possible they've maybe tried to poison you. And that's what's made you ill. Maybe they're trying to remove your memory of showing you these things." And he brought this up in much later life, actually. And it became a sort of news story. It was in the news here and stuff. Bernard Lovell poisoned. And I think they were talking about maybe irradiating him with microwave radiation or something, with these very strong radar transmitters or something. But it doesn't really... We all talked about, you know, him and his son, and we've talked about it. And I'm not sure it really rings true. He had a diary where he'd written down all the details of what he'd seen, and he was allowed. He brought the diary home,
and surely he was of value to them anywhere, as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, even if he hadn't have stayed.
So we're not convinced that the poisoning story holds water, but it's certainly true that he was trying to persuade him to defect, and it's certainly true that he got very stressed and worried about it, and that's probably what made him ill, is the pressure and the stress of that whole situation. And of course, that's 1963. That was just after the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? In October 62, when, you know, they must have known, of course.
Yeah.
They presumably knew that Chodrill was an early warning system. I'd sort of be surprised that they didn't have.
Well, chances are they had people in GCHQ who
were feeding some information back. So it's all that game of what each other knew. So it would have been a very strange time. But they will have a wonder.
I just want to take a photo of the
plaque.
This lovely 1950s.
This is the best picture I could find online of some of the instruments in the Crimea. This is one of the telescopes Lovell describes in his diary.
Right.
But you get these, you know, declassified US stuff.
Yeah.
Which you can sometimes find some of these pictures in these days. Evpatoria, it's called, the location. It's obviously a bit of a challenging thing. But here's Alla Maseyevich, who was a major figure in Soviet science. She was in charge of all the optical tracking facilities they used for their space program. Mm. But this is
Daily Express or Daily... Oh, there you go. Daily Express. I could tell.
The headline
says, "Beautiful boffins of bid to woo Newton of radio astronomy to defect to the USSR." Brilliant.
There's probably some truth in it.
Yeah.
There's probably some truth in it. But, yeah. So there she is. There's Alla Maseyevich with Lovell. And the claim in this article from 2012 is that Lovell was...
Subject to a honey trap of some sort.
Now, whether or not, I don't know the truth of that element of the story. It's certainly true they tried to persuade him to defect in this visit that they refer to.
Yeah.
I think this article, if you read it, claims to have included an interview with an ex-KGB colonel or something,
right,
and knows some of the background to it. So it's possibly...
It would make sense that if they're trying to get him to defect, they're going to try other... methods rather than just
but they knew each other anyway, these two, so I mean I think they got on quite well, and she'd visited Jodrell and whatever, so. But it was I mean, that whole, you know, there was a whole bunch of stuff that went on there. I mean, this is the very first picture ever sent from the surface of the moon by a spacecraft that landed on the moon. It was done by the Soviets in 1966, Luna 9, and basically we hacked into it here. And we printed it on a Daily Express picture receiver, in fact. So the Daily Express were very kind and lent us a forerunner of the fax machine. They used to transmit pictures around the world on telephone lines. Basically, that J.G. Davis here recognised the form of the signal this spacecraft was sending out. They were obviously, again, this was a spying mission, really.
Mm.
Even though it's in the news here, the spying stuff was never admitted to. We now know what the story was, but But they, he said, oh, you know, that signal sounds like one of these, you know, like a fax type signal.
Yeah.
So they borrowed this thing, put out the call, the Daily Express brought this. They effectively plugged it into the telescope and out came a picture of the
Brilliant.
The very first picture ever sent from the surface of the moon.
Yeah.
So it was amazing stuff. But we know, again, we've got the records now, the tape recordings of these signals were sent to GCHQ, they analysed them, they sent them on to the US, and they analysed them, and it was all about working out what they were capable of
doing.
Well,
the US were obviously wanting to see how far they were getting ahead in the race to get, you know, a human on the moon.
Exactly, So there's all sorts of, you know, you know, these sorts of Cold War stories that Jodrell was part of. It was part of this, if you were to Google Project Flower Garden, you'll find declassified reports on this, which is basically obviously the Soviets had their own missile defence radar systems, like Filindales or our systems. These are strong radio signals being sent out. Some of them go out with the atmosphere, some of them hit the moon, and they come back to Earth. Mm-hmm. So if you just point your very sensitive radio telescope at the moon, you can hear the echoes of the missile's defence system. And so Jodrell was part of that project. It's called these Hen House. I think they're supposed to look like a battery farm.
Yeah, it does.
So they're called the Hen House radar systems. So we apparently were the site that helped determine the strength of that. And of course, I guess the idea was, you know, the power of the radar, you know, maybe you could find out the way in which they change the frequencies, you can work out how to jam it or whatever might be.
Yeah.
Or build some...
Yeah.
Design your aircraft shape or structure or something to...
Some way of countering it.
Countering it in some way. So I think there's... Although we probably haven't uncovered all the stories, there's a whole bunch of these sorts of... Oh, we're going to go down here.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of these sorts of Cold War episodes, some bits of which were in the public domain, but turns out the whole... bunch of them were not.
So is this where you keep the aliens?
This is where we keep the aliens. We're going down the steps into our cellar basement below the control building. One of the reasons we're going down here is because I just want to show you it because it's fun. So this is effectively a plant room now. So it's where our internet signals come in, and you can see some of the old equipment down here. But new sort of breaker units and all that.
Yeah.
But this is one of the fun features of this, is the secret. This is where we keep our aliens.
Now that is definitely...
That's an impressive tunnel. So this is a tunnel that extends from below our control building directly out to below the centre of the Lovell telescope.
Right.
So if you want to get to and from the telescope unseen, or, you know, out of the
rain... Who would want to do that unseen, eh?
I don't know. So you sort
of... Oh, wow.
It's a pretty interesting view. Obviously, all the cabling from the telescope comes down this tunnel, obviously, as well. But it is a way of getting to and from.
Yeah.
If you wanted to do that without wandering about above ground.
Get the aliens out without anybody seeing.
Somewhere along there, there's a secret door, and that leads to the...
Yeah.
The other reason... Let me just... Jodrell's an interesting place. It's got sort of modern, very modern things.
Yeah.
Like, we've got very fast supercomputers and things, but they're mixed in with what's clearly quite an old, you know, Cold War era... building and site, where you'll still see bits and pieces of equipment that watch your step.
Oh, thank you.
That are left over. Now I'm just gonna, can you just hold that? I'm just gonna move this ladder, and we're just gonna have a look in here. So this is our telephone system. So this is all the wiring up, you know, the junction box for the telephone system. And the only reason I want to come in here is because I just want to show you something that our computer manager found, if it's still here. Let me just look for it. A few years ago. Bear with me while I just...
No, that's fine.
...flick through these. You can edit this waiting out if you like.
build the drama.
The drama
we'll
of
have a drum roll.
So these are the cards that are, oh god, they're double sided. I'm gonna have to look at both sides. Hang on a minute. These are the cards that are used to indicate all our sort of telephone wiring.
So if somebody's done work
system
on it,
yeah,
they
tell you which. They tell you which of these little things is connected to which telephone and all this sort of business. So you know, there's a private wire to Oxford Road, Manchester,
Telex,
which is where the
line.
All these sorts of things are all recorded in here. Oh, here we go.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Why would you need a phone line direct to Cheltenham?
Interesting,
isn't it? And a telex as well.
Yeah. Private wire, PW.
Yeah.
Private wire to Cheltenham, telephone and the telex. And here's another one. And at the top, the address is Lab 5 upstairs, the secret space tracking lab, which we've just been in. So that's been sitting
wow.
there since, well... There's no actual date on here. This it seems to say revised 10/74. I suspect that's October 74. So it's post October 74.
Can I take a photo of that?
Yeah.
Is that right?
I mean, I've got a photo. You can take a photo of me holding it if you like. I think so, yeah. I don't think there's anything.
Well, neither of us have probably signed
no,
the Official
no,
Secrets Act,
no.
So I think we're all right.
I must admit, I know that's in there. Our computer manager found this. And as I say, you do find things. It's just sitting around in
well,
here.
Well, as you say,
it?
It's such an old building, and there's like
yeah.
bits of, like that stuff's been
no,
sitting
no,
in there since 1974.
So he will have been wiring up some connection because he's doing our internet or whatever else, and then he's just happened to notice this thing. The one I said that's almost. Here's another one, look. There, the famous phrase GCHQ just appears in the middle of there for some reason. And I'll have to read through that and work out what the heck it is.
Fax computer. I mean, that's 80s.
I started my research work on a Vax. So we know. Yeah, as I say,
wow.
I'm sure I don't know and haven't been told all the stories of Jodrell Bank's involvement, but there's evidence for it just sitting around here.
I love
which
it.
Is quite
it's
fun.
Like, it's like a detective story.
It is a detective story.
Finding these little clues.
Yeah. So I think our GCHQ colleagues have a site now in Manchester,
right.
And I think we may end up with a little display about the connection to Jodrell Bank
yeah.
in that location as well. Actually, let's just see if we can see who's on duty in the control room, and we can pop in. Hiya, Mirza. How are you? It's okay if I bring a colleague in? We're recording a podcast about the Cold War and Jodrell Bank's work during that period, so you don't mind if we just talk and... Yeah, I'll put some stuff
okay.
Mirza's the controller on duty today.
Hi, Mirza. Thank you for letting me into your workspace.
He's got 9 telescopes to look after.
Yeah,
so. Yeah. So this is the control room. With the Lab 5 space we were in before is up behind the
right.
So those windows that look down are on a wall underneath
yeah.
this false ceiling here. But this is the original.
I was going to say this is. I've seen a photo of this.
Yeah. So this is the superstructure, at least, is the original control
yeah.
desk. The innards have changed, and in fact this top and the dials have changed over the years, but the actual original grey horseshoe desk is still here. Of course, these days, mostly the controller and others will operate the telescopes via computers.
Yeah.
They didn't have digital computers at that time that were operating it, but then we still use this for... effectively, generally for manual control. So if you want to drive the telescope or you want to emergency stop it...
Yeah, I've let the big red button that's got me.
It's become bigger in recent years, that button. seems to have got bigger and bigger. We have a tunnel flood alert,
So the secret tunnel that we just saw has the... If that happened to get flooded, that would... But there's wind monitoring, and again here.
So I guess you have to monitor the wind in order to turn the dish so it doesn't effectively act like a big sail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it would, you know, if the wind's very strong, then you could blow the whole thing down. So keeping an eye on the weather is a big part of the job of the controller, looking after the safety of the equipment and so on. But also these sorts of alarms, one of which just went off then. A wind alarm, as it says.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a little bit... Right. So there's basically four telescopes here.
Yeah.
Two big ones. The Mark One, as it was, which is now the Lovell, and the Mark Two.
Right, where it parked.
Which is near... It's where the original big transit telescope was. We've got another five telescopes spread across the country. So... Yeah, up to 200 kilometres, and we link them all together as a single giant telescope now. But you can see this room was built for that telescope, right?
Well, it feels like, you know, mission control. You know, it's got shades of that going on.
It's got a bit
on.
Of Bond supervillain place, hasn't it? So
enough away.
If we're doing anything secret still, we'll have kept it very well hidden. So.
Yeah.
Behind this
screen, then,
or under this box. But and then this is like the control station for all the other telescopes, if you can see the CCTV images of them there. So it's probably a bit more like what you might expect a control system to look like rather than that horseshoe.
But I'm glad you kept that because it is the integral part of the.
This is that balance of.
And that looks pretty.
that's heritage as well. It's a pair of. World War II binoculars, basically. But they're used for... I don't know where it's... Is it pointing at the telescope?
Yeah.
Wow. So the controllers actually use them to see... Because there's sometimes... They want to have a close look at what's going on the structure without having to go out there. Or even if there's an engineer working out there, they need to have a look at what's going on. They can see that from here. They're actually good quality optics.
They are, a bit.
But let's go down here. So this is not the cellar was below this, right? Yeah. So this is the sort of, I don't know what we call this, the basement or something. Got two different names for these places. But these are, you know, this is where they would have had equipment here. This is actually where they had the fax thing, you know, we talked about for Luna 9 in 1966, where they hacked into the picture from the moon. That was in here. So a lot of detective work goes in, me basically, looking at old press photos of these events.
And trying to match up.
And looking at the window frames in the background. And I worked out it was down, basically it was down here.
Wow.
Where they had that stuff. And again, a lot of these places end up being storerooms. A lot of our equipment tends to get smaller.
This is Monday, July the 21st. And the time is 15:40, 32 seconds.
I'm just listening. Just accidentally press play on a recording of Lovell.
In the spacecraft after a walk on the moon, and are due to lift off from the lunar surface
This is actually a recording of what was done in July 1969, where for fun we listened in on the Americans on the moon, but the secret mission was to use the big Lovell telescope here to track a Soviet spacecraft called Luna 15. I think it's generally just forgotten about, but at the same time that the Americans were on the moon, orbiting the moon was this Soviet robot spacecraft. There were no people on board. And its mission was to land on the moon, scoop up a sample of lunar soil and
try and get it ahead of...
Well, it probably wouldn't have made it ahead of the Americans getting back. It probably wouldn't have gone back to Earth, but there was a very strong chance that the Americans could have failed, died on the moon.
Yeah.
The Russians, the Soviets could have succeeded in bringing back a sample of lunar soil and done the scientific analysis.
Yeah.
And it would have been a massive coup for the Soviet Union compared to the US.
Yeah.
To have it that way around. And I think, you know, it could have easily been that way around.
Yeah.
The reality was everything went okay for the Americans. And the Russian spacecraft crashed into the moon attempting to land.
Yeah.
But the crash was recorded by Jodrell with the signals for actually, for both GCHQ and the US and for the USSR, because the crash happened, they were listening to the signal, they were recording it. We've got the recordings of the tape made by Lovell that he then sent to GCHQ and was sent on to the US, with him narrating when these bits of things happened and what they were recorded. Just after the crash happened and the signal stopped from the Soviet spacecraft, the telephone rang here. It was the president of the Soviet Academy of Sciences on the phone, this guy called Keldysh, on the phone for Lovell from Moscow, saying, have you been listening in on our spacecraft? And Lovell said, yes, we've been recording the signal. He said, would it be okay if we had a copy of the tapes? And Lovell said, oh yes, that's no problem, I'll put them in a diplomatic bag. And this guy said, oh no, it's okay, don't worry, we've already got a man in the air on the way. So this guy arrived at Ringway Airport, as it was, Manchester Airport. Just north of here, and the chief engineer here drove up to the airport with a box with the recording of the Luna 15 crash on it, handed it over to the guy, who got back on a plane and flew back to Moscow.
Wow.
Now, if it was, I don't know if it was exactly the same recording, the full same tape that was given to our side, if you like.
Yeah.
But it tells you how...
But it would also have shown what sort of capability Jodrell had in terms of what it was able to pick up. So, you know, it's been...
I think it's giving with one hand and taking with the other, isn't it, in some way? And I guess it was mutually beneficial. Yeah. And there was sort of more esoteric signs, if you like, stars and whatever, that Lovell was studying that they would have collaborated on anyway. But on this sort of technology side, then, it was very much this sort of almost... Yeah, I've always sort of considered it almost in this semi-neutral position. Obviously, they were more the Western side than the Soviet side, but they sort of worked with both.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess you can see both with stars and stuff like that, it's neutral ground.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you get onto the technological capabilities,
strange.
Were there Soviet scientists in the US as well on exchanges and working with NASA like that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. We had conferences and things here. There were various conferences and workshops. And we certainly got visitors from the Soviet Union who came here. And obviously they had to have permission to come. And, you know, well in advance. And there would have been someone, you know, official... looking after them.
Yeah.
Imagine the same probably happened with the US.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't see.
Because obviously they had the Apollo Soyuz project in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a degree of cooperation there during that period.
Well, there's just too many great stories. I mean, there was a thing that it was an early sort of communications experiment, over the horizon communications, where there was a balloon called the Echo balloon. So it was a balloon that was launched that was reflective to radio waves. And the experiment was going to be to try and use this high-altitude balloon to send a signal, bounce it off the balloon, get it over the horizon and do communication that way. So before they had satellites. This was all going well until the Americans' balloon. And so there was an American colonel or something here. There's a military involvement. And then they wanted to get the Russians involved as well with their instrument in the Crimea. And then basically the Americans vetoed it. They didn't want them sending signals to their balloon or whatever it was, you know. And it was this guy, J.G. Davis, here who said, and they were all very frustrated because they just wanted to do it. They were just enjoying themselves, having doing this thing. And this guy said, oh, we're not letting the... No, sorry, you haven't got permission to let the Soviets be involved in this project or something. And then J.G. Davis said, oh, we got everything set up. Tell you what, let's use the moon. The Americans don't own the moon. was his lie.
Brilliant.
So they used the moon as the reflector instead. But there's sort of... Yeah, there's just all that sort of thing going on all the time. So, I don't know. It was interesting times, I suspect.
Yeah.
This is the noise, not one of our noisy rooms, just because of the air conditioning for our computer systems. So basically, it's that sort of, I always think Jodrell's interesting because you go from one room, which is, you know,
50s technology,
yeah. And it's got some, into a room that's basically the current cutting edge of computer systems, so, which we're using to study ripples in space-time from supermassive black holes at the edge of the universe, you know.
Unbelievable.
Which is genuinely what we're doing with that machine, so. And we need to sweep up in here, so it's a bit of a... But who's got time to sweep up when you've got supermassive black holes?
Oh, when you've got exciting stuff like that.
Exactly, exactly.
Look at.
So, one of the things that just came to mind was these KGBs, the sort of agents that would be alongside the visitors. And I remember one of Lovell's children who, you know, I mean, Lovell would have been, well, what would he have been? He would have been 110 or something if he was still around. So his children are obviously getting on a bit. But they were saying they remembered these people coming and staying. I think Ms. Alla Masevich stayed at Lovell's house and coming with these people.
Right.
The minders.
Yeah.
I think it was his eldest son, Brian, who said, anyway, there's a story, this person coming in there saying, oh, yeah, no, sorry, he doesn't speak English, you know, whatever. And it was like, okay, he just tags around with him, but he doesn't speak English. And then basically overhearing him in another room talking perfect English with somebody else.
Yeah.
Story that it was okay, they don't understand what you're talking about. Of course, that wasn't at all true. So it was must have been a really funny time. The most recent secret project I'm aware of was in 1983. And that was a project that I heard the details of from Francis Graham Smith, who was the director after Lovell. So was brought in on the secret knowledge.
Yeah.
Lovell retired in 81. What happened was that there was a cover story. The Americans had a very high-resolution spectrometer, so it basically takes a radio signal and it looks at the fine detail of the frequencies within that signal. It can map the spectrum of that signal at very fine high resolution across a very wide range of spectrum. And so they developed this receiver, and it was in a big truck that they flew in from the US, probably came into Burton Wood or somewhere, one of the air bases nearby. And they drove it here, and it was parked out the front here of the building. And it said NASA on the side. I'll show you a picture of it, actually. Not parked outside. And sadly, I don't have a picture of it parked outside our building here. But I did find a picture of it in Goldstone when it was in the USA. Mm-hmm. So a big trailer with big NASA symbol on the outside. And this is Graham Smith's writing. Says this was the visit of a huge NASA trailer to Jodrell, ostensibly for SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yeah.
That was the cover story. But including a search for radio channels, I think he says, from Russian spacecraft. So basically there'd been a band that they suspected the Soviets were using on board their spacecraft. Now, of course, there were space probes that went to Venus and wherever that the Soviets were very good at, and it would have been used in those. But of course, they had many other spacecraft used for lots of other stuff.
Yeah.
Of a more, you know, military perspective, probably using the same technology. So they wanted to find where this band was, and they'd been searching for it for 21 years, apparently, and they could not find. And they'd been trying to work it out by reverse engineering. They'd found photographs of some of the technology, so you can tell from the shape of some of the horns and things what frequency it might be and so on. So they were trying to pin it down, and basically they came in that project, which was publicised as being a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which you could have used that kit for, and maybe they did at the same time, and they used it for some other astronomy. But actually, the real reason was because they wanted to do this study of this particular spacecraft. And they did detect it here,
And this is Bob Pritchard's words, the Americans were cock-a-hoop. And they finally found this thing.
21 years later.
21 years later. Wow. But that's the most recent thing I'm aware of that was done under the banner of this link with GCHQ.
The UK, I mean, there was that scandal, I think it was in the 1980s, where the UK had secretly funded a satellite, Zircon.
Right.
And it was a spy, some sort of spy satellite system. And Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist, had revealed it. I can't exactly remember the circumstances on it, but I just wonder whether...
Possibly.
There was, you know, some input or...
I don't know. I mean, I genuinely don't know. It's possible. It's possible that I'm almost certain I don't know everything there is to know.
I don't actually know
one way or the other.
You've got enough. I mean, we've covered some great stories.
I mean, this is Bob, who sadly died last year or the year before last. Last year, I think. So Bob, it was interesting. I was pleased that Bob was able to talk about things before he died, actually, because... He said, you know, he found it a very difficult time because he couldn't. You can imagine what people here would be like.
Yeah.
There was all the suspicions. Oh, is that the men from the ministry? Is that the men from Shelton? Have they gone up the staircase at the back into? Yeah. And of course, you know, there was a lot. Oh, is the telescope pointing at the moon?
Mm.
You could see where the telescope pointed roughly. Mm. And so he was often being badgered by people and a bit of Mickey taking and so on, you know. But he couldn't say, you know.
Yeah.
So I think he did find it a bit difficult, and very gentle, sort of mild-mannered chap, actually, Bob.
Yeah.
So it was good to talk to him.
Well, it must have been a real relief for him to be able to actually know
that it was okay, because he was just assuming, until he's told otherwise, he's not going to say anything.
Yeah, yeah,
and he never did.
Yeah.
So...
I mean, it's like those people at Bletchley Park who, you know... never told their families.
No.
Never revealed.
No. So.
But he had a chance.
They're good. They're interesting stories from an interesting and challenging and probably very worrying at the times period of history, isn't it?
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.